Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. Listener discretion is advised.
We had witness statements, outlines of arguments. I mean, we had a complete ready file. He came through Birmingham, and we offered him that file. We offered to sit down with him. We offered to outline our defense with him, to give him the witness statement, everything that we had. All he wanted to do, and all we did, was feed him steak and Scotch whiskey at the club in Birmingham and hear him ramble on about what a fabulous lawyer he was. Truth of the matter is, Percy Forman was the biggest fraud and blowhard I ever encountered in over 50 years of practicing law. I saw absolutely no evidence ever, either directly or secondhand, of any inclination or willingness on his part to defend that case as it should have been defended.
I called the union hall. I said, it's a matter of life and death. I said, I think these people are planning to kill Dr. King.
The authorities would parade, oh, we found a gun that James Earl Ray bought in Birmingham that killed Dr. King. Except, it wasn't the gun that killed Dr. King.
James Earl Ray was a pawn for the official story.
From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV,
the plan was to get King to the city because they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it.
And I have lived with it so long, my children, they scared for me. The Lord told me to not to worry. I've been wanting to tell it all my life.
I'm Bill Klaber, and this is the MLK Tapes. Speaking from experience, when one tries to open a conversation about who shot Martin Luther King, if the person you're talking to knows anything at all about the case, they immediately come back with, but the guy said he did it. And the answer to that is a patient, no, he didn't. He always denied it. But of course, James Earl Ray did, in the end, plead guilty. So how did that plea come about? And what does it tell us about the murder? As we heard in the last episode, Arthur Haynes, Jr. and Sr. were criminal defense attorneys who came to represent James Earl Ray, the man accused of killing Martin Luther King. Ray was an escaped con. He had been in Memphis that day, and there did seem to be some connection between him and the murder of Dr. King. But despite all the public posturing by the prosecution, Ray's attorneys were surprised to find that the actual case against Ray was weak. It seemed to them that the connection to the murder was that their client had been set up. They investigated, interviewed witnesses, and worked on the case for 4 months. As the trial approached, they thought they had good chances for an acquittal. Then, the night before the trial was to begin, they were handed a note that said they had been removed from the case. Why did Forman push his way into the case? Did you ever wonder about that?
Did we ever wonder why and how Forman got in the case? Only every day from that day until the day my father died.
When I sat down with Art Haynes Jr. in Birmingham, he tried to explain how famous criminal defense attorney Percy Forman had pushed them aside. There were pressure points. How to pay for the defense was one of them. Ray had no money, and Haynes, father and son, could not afford to work for nothing and pay all the costs of the defense as well. Haynes knew a successful investigative writer named William Bradford Huey, who was also from Alabama and who was interested in writing about the King murder. Huey's books included The Americanization of Emily, The Execution of Private Slavik, and The Revolt of Mamie Stover, all of which were made into movies. He also wrote Wolf Whistle, the story of the murder of the young Emmett Till, and Three Lives from Mississippi, which told of the murders of the three civil rights workers in Neshoba County. The foreword to this book was written by Martin Luther King. No one at the time knew what the real story was with Ray and King, but Huey sensed there was a book there and possibly a movie, and he was willing to put money up front to get access, money that was needed to fund the defense of James Earl Ray. To Art Haynes, it seemed like a promising offer, and he brought it to James.
William Bradford Huey, the author who was writing for Look magazine, whom we had encouraged Ray to hire because Huey was a noted anti-George Wallace. He was in the middle of a series of articles for Esquire. He had every credential being in Dr. King's camp, and he was from Alabama and close to us, so we encouraged him to hire Huey.
Haynes Sr. brought a deal to Ray where, in simple numbers, Ray would receive 30% of whatever Huey's books and articles brought in, Huey would get 40%, and Haynes 30%. Judge Preston Battle would not permit anyone besides his attorneys and his immediate family to visit or talk to Ray. So the arrangement was made for Huey to submit questions to Ray and for Ray to write out his answers in longhand.
All that summer, I had carried questions from Huey to Ray, and Ray's handwritten answers back to Huey. We had facilitated that.
All 200 pages of Ray's answers to Huey's questions have been preserved and make for an interesting read if you can decipher Ray's handwriting. It's the same story Ray has told before of his prison break and his moving about the country at the direction of a man named Raoul. Huey took these notes and actually traced Ray's travels and found the people Ray said he had worked for or met along the way. The one exception was Raoul. This was not surprising because Ray didn't know Raoul's last name, his address, or even if Raoul was his real first name. Ray spent a great deal of time writing these pages, and at first he was satisfied with how his attorneys were going about things. But not everyone was.
I suppose we were naive in that we thought we were lawyers hired to defend a murder case, and that's what we were doing. There were all kinds of purported witness hangers-on and people involved who wanted to be a part of it. Well, Jerry Ray was one of those. He wanted to come to Birmingham and have us support him and let him be part of the defense. Truthfully, we didn't have time for that. We were trying to manage our practice and at the same time get that case ready for trial. And we just didn't have time or inclination to fool with Jerry Ray. We were polite, but not responsive to that.
But Jerry Ray did get himself involved. He visited James in prison, his attorneys in Birmingham, and author William Bradford Huey in Huntsville. And he was also in touch with a certain attorney in Texas who would soon arrive in Memphis. According to everyone close to the case, James Earl Ray very much wanted to go to trial. As Jerry Ray would say, he didn't kill King, and he wanted his chance to prove it in court. But this is where the trouble started. James imagined a trial where he would be able to tell his story, where he, James Earl Ray, would be able to look the jurors in the eye and have them believe that he did not shoot Martin Luther King. But Arthur Haynes Sr. was an experienced attorney, and he knew that great danger awaited a defendant when he took the witness stand, especially if the defendant had, like Ray, a long record of criminal conduct that the prosecution could explore in great detail, until that's pretty much all the jury would remember as they concluded that such an outlaw should get what he deserved. So as Arthur Haynes explains, they were not ready to promise Ray that he would take the stand.
Our view of it was that we wouldn't know whether Ray was going to testify or need to testify until the end of the state's case. Obviously, if he had testified, that would have killed the value of Huey's connection to him.
This is how Jerry Ray saw it.
On November 1st, 1968, I flew down to Hartsville, Alabama, and talked to Huey Pate on my way down, because he wanted another contact besides the attorney. So he was showing me his contracts, and so he told me, the only thing is, now you go back and tell James he's not going to take the witness stand, because he doesn't know how to look. So I went back and told James you ought to call Haynes because Huey's run the case.
So with a little help from Brother Jerry, James began to fear that the case was not being pursued with his best interests in mind. He wanted to testify, and it seemed that Huey and his book was now standing in the way. And then, the weekend before his trial was to begin, he received a visit from a famous Texas lawyer named Percy Foreman. Foreman was 6'4" and weighed 250 pounds and had a huge reputation to go with it. He had grown up poor in the wilds of East Texas, quit school when he was 15, and made something of himself because he had an agile mind and a quick tongue. He put himself through law school and came out ready for bear. He had a knack for talking in a way that juries liked, and he was especially good at representing people accused of murder. In his 40 years of criminal law, he claimed to have represented over 1,000. Of those, only one, as the story goes, was ever executed, and according to Foreman, only 66 of the 1,000 spent even a day in jail. The more obviously guilty, the easier it seemed for him to get them off, for a price. He was hated by the prosecutors he faced, and also hated by his clients. When they felt the most vulnerable is when he could have them sign over every asset they had. "I don't represent wealthy clients," he once said. "If they aren't poor when they come to me, they are when they leave." Foreman had been talking to Jerry Ray, so he knew all the right buttons to push. He told James that Haynes should not have made a deal like that with Huey. Who was Huey to give advice to his attorney based on what might or might not be good for a book? Foreman talked about all the famous people he knew and all the cases he had won, and how James' case would be the easiest one he ever argued. And added to that, Foreman said that unlike the Haynes defense team, he was wealthy. Wealthy enough to move forward without any literary contracts, and they'd figure out how to pay his fee after the trial. But for a retainer, he had James sign over the title to his Mustang and the Remington 3006 that he purchased in Birmingham, the one that was said to have killed King. Here's Ray.
Foreman came to the jail and seen me. He told me that if I would dismiss Haynes and hire him, he wouldn't get involved in any literary contracts. Mm-hmm. He financed the trial. And after the trial was over, then he would get his fee then. Mm-hmm. So I agreed to that, and I signed some type of paper he dictated dismissing Haynes and hiring him. Well, on one of the initial hearings before the trial court, mm-hmm. Foreman promised Judge Battle he wouldn't get involved in any literary contracts. Yeah. At that time, I didn't know it, but he was negotiating with Huey to take over Haynes' interest in the contract at that time.
So Foreman's big promise to Ray was the case would not be driven by literary contracts, that he, Foreman, was rich enough to defend Ray without them. But a week after he had taken over the case, Foreman and Huey met for lunch in Dallas. Huey described that meeting in his book, He Slew the Dreamer. Quote, "Mr. Foreman liked my three-way contract. All he wanted was for Mr. Haynes to get out of the way so he could have what Mr. Haynes had. So you get Haynes out of the way," he said, "and then, goddammit, get to work and write us a good book, make us a good movie, and make us some money."
I didn't see too much of him, and then subsequently in January of 1969, he came up there with a literary contract, and he asked me to sign it, and I signed it, and in February 3rd, he asked me to sign another literary contract. And this specified that anything I got would go to him.
The contracts that Foreman had Ray sign on January 29th and February 3rd essentially stripped Ray of every remaining asset he had or might have. So why did he sign them? As Ray would explain later, Foreman had come to see him in late January saying the case was going very well, but he needed to bring in another attorney, John J. Hooker, and that was going to cost money. So Ray, not really having a choice, signed everything over to Foreman. Now, if Foreman had been telling the truth about representing from the start that a plea bargain was their only option, there would have been no reason for Ray to enter into these contracts. So as late as February 3rd, Foreman was saying that they were going to trial and things were looking good. But just 10 days later, after Foreman had plucked his client clean, as Bradford Huey would describe it, Foreman came back with bad news. Ray had to plead guilty.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, on February the 13th, he came into prison, the jail. He appeared agitated, and he suggested I enter a guilty plea. He said that the news media didn't convict me. When he came back to see me next time, he was talking about, he said they might prosecute my brother Jerry Ray for conspiracy murders. And also he said they might imprison my father.
James' brother Jerry tells the same story of Foreman's about face.
And Percy Foreman came in and said, this is going to be the easiest case I ever had in my life. There's no evidence at all of this. And he did that up until about a month before the guilty plea. Then he started crying and said, they're going to execute him, they're going to do this and that. So James asked to resign the case because he's trying to go to trial anyway. And Foreman wouldn't resign.
At this point, James Earl Ray was boxed in. He was stuck with Foreman, and Foreman refused to perform. He kept telling Ray that the prosecution wanted to turn him into barbecue, Foreman's word. Then he told Ray that if he insisted on going to trial, they would put his father and brother in jail. When Ray said he still wanted a trial, Foreman said flat out that he wouldn't defend him. He didn't feel up to it. Here is an interchange between Bill Pepper and Jerry Ray at the 99 civil trial.
Well, I came down to visit him, and he told me, too, the last time I seen him, he still hadn't made up his mind. He still was fighting to go to court. And he told me that Foreman told him if he did plead guilty, they was going to put my dad in prison, which my dad had jumped parole back in the 20s, and is going to charge me with being accessory to the murder.
I'm going to show you a letter, Jerry, that was written to James Earl Ray, my first informant.
Yeah, I know all about this. It's,
what is the day of that letter?
March 9th, 1969.
March what?
9th.
March 9th, 1969.
Yeah.
And when was the guilty plea here?
It was
March 10th,
yeah.
The following day. This is a letter from his counsel on the eve of trial. And this letter offers him $500. What conditions was he offered $500
by? Yeah, if he don't do no, if he pleads guilty and don't embarrass him in the court, then it was agreement.
We understand that $500 was to be taken to hire a new lawyer, he
yeah.
had to set it aside.
Yeah.
This agreement, signed the day before Ray entered his guilty plea, is a strange document. Foreman signs on for a fee of $165,000, if such is produced by books or movies, and Ray is handed $500. The purpose of the $500 is not stated in the contract, but according to both James and Jerry, it was so Ray could go find a lawyer to overturn the plea, as if $500 could accomplish such a thing. But Ray is to get the $500 only if he meets two conditions. He enters a plea of guilty of murder in the first degree, and he doesn't make a scene of any kind at the proceeding. And that's what unfolds.
Are you pleading guilty to murder in the first degree in this case because you killed Dr. Martin Luther King under such circumstances that it would make you legally guilty of murder in the first degree under the law as explained to you by your lawyer?
Ray's answer was barely audible on the recording system used by the court. What he said was, quote, yes, legally guilty,
According to attorney Mark Lane, who would later represent Ray, Ray told him that when Foreman was using every kind of argument to push him into a plea, Ray blurted out that he didn't want to plead guilty because he hadn't shot King. Doesn't matter, replied Foreman. If you were involved in any kind of illegal activity with those who did, you are legally guilty. You are as guilty as the man who pulled the trigger. Foreman was referring to the concept of felony murder, where if three people, say, agree to rob a store, and they all agree that no one is to be hurt, but something goes wrong and one man pulls a gun and kills the store clerk, all three men are legally guilty of the murder. Most states have such laws, though it is far from clear that such a concept would apply in a case where one man is purposely deceived about the crime and brought along only for the purpose of taking the blame. But Foreman's little lesson was most likely how the phrase legally guilty became part of Ray's plea. After the plea was entered, Ray's attorney Percy Foreman was invited to speak. He stood up and addressed the court. This is what he had to say. It's an honor to appear in this court. I never expected or had any idea when I entered this case that I would be able to accomplish anything, except perhaps save the defendant's life. All of us, all of you, were as well informed as I was about the facts of this case, due to the fact that we have such an effective news media. Took me a month to convince myself of that which the Attorney General of the United States and J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI announced last July, that there was no conspiracy. After that bit of self-congratulations from Percy Foreman, Ray asked Judge Battle if he might say something. The judge agreed, and I'll read a slightly edited version of what followed. Ray, I don't want to change anything that I have said. I don't want to add anything onto it either. The only thing I have to say is, I don't exactly accept the theories of Mr. Clark. In other words, I'm not bound to accept the theories of Mr. Clark. This is an aside. But Percy Foreman, who had just referred to Attorney General of the United States, doesn't know who Ray is speaking about. So he asks, who is Mr. Clark? Ray, Ramsey Clark. Foreman, oh. Ray, and Mr. Hoover. Foreman, Mr. Who? Ray, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. I'm not trying to change anything. I just want to add something onto it. Judge Battle, you don't agree with those theories? Ray, I mean on the conspiracy thing. There is a bit of crosstalk, and no one seems inclined to ask Ray what it is he's trying to say. Judge Battle then asks if he is still pleading guilty to first-degree murder, and Ray says that he is. It was a short, tense moment. Ray had gone off script, but he hadn't caused a huge scene, so he would still get his $500. 3 days after recording his guilty plea, James Earl Ray wrote to Judge Preston Battle and asked to have the plea overturned and allow him to go to trial. A few days later, he wrote again asking for the same thing. It was not clear how Judge Battle was going to rule on Ray's petitions. Often, in the interest of justice, such petitions are granted. But before Battle could make a decision, he was found slumped over his desk, dead from an apparent heart attack. And according to various accounts, Battle was slumped over Ray's petitions on which he was to rule. A new judge replaced Battle, and he didn't allow Ray to reopen the case. So Ray was led off to prison, no trial. But Percy Forman's statement at the end of the trial is curious. If Forman was so certain that Ray had to plead guilty, why did he connive to get himself into the case? And what was all this talk about the easiest case I've ever argued?
Did you ever feel that you could ever do more than save his life?
Never at any time, and so told him from the day I came in. And he never expected anything else from the first, and I never expected to accomplish this.
This statement by Percy Forman, made out on the street after Ray's so-called trial, is most certainly a lie, and a big one. Forman says here that he told Ray on the first day that they met that his only hope was to plead guilty and take a life sentence. But if that were true, why would Ray need to change lawyers? Haynes, father and son, already possessed a plea offer from the prosecution, as Art Haynes revealed to me when we spoke.
Were you ever offered a plea bargain?
Oh, absolutely. We were offered a better deal than he took. I think there was a little anxiety on the part of the prosecution as to the strength of the case.
Haynes said that the deal they had been offered was better than the one Ray finally had to settle for, but it was better only in that it allowed him an earlier date from which he would be eligible for parole. Not much of a difference, because no one was going to let the convicted murderer of Martin Luther King out on parole. But if Ray wished to take a guilty plea in exchange for life in prison, he already had that. He didn't need the services of some fancy outside lawyer. But Ray wasn't thinking plea bargain. He was thinking trial, and he went with Forman because Forman says his would be an easy case to win. So why was Forman now saying that he'd always told Ray that his only chance was to plead guilty? Some insights into this are provided by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which published a deposition of Forman pursuant to a lawsuit brought by Ray concerning the representation he received. Attorney James Lazar asked Forman exactly what he had done on behalf of his client. Did he hire an investigator? Forman said he hadn't. Then how did he investigate the case? Forman fumbled about and then said he hired 6 or 8 Memphis Law School students who worked for him. What did he ask them to do? Forman couldn't quite remember now. What were their names? He couldn't remember that either. Well, surely their names could be found on their pay stubs. Forman said they had been paid in cash. Well, where would their work product be? Forman didn't know, but he probably had it somewhere. Forman then said he owned 80 vacant houses, which were all filled with his case records, but he kept no list of what was where. Forman did say he interviewed some witnesses, but he couldn't say where the records of this might be found. And so it went. But from these questions and answers, it became apparent that Percy Forman had nothing to show that he had done any work on behalf of his client, James Earl Ray. When Percy Forman appeared before the House Select Committee, he was asked if he had ever compared notes with Ray's previous attorneys.
Did you ever consult with Mr. Haynes, who had also reviewed the evidence, to see whether he agreed with you? Did you ever consult with Arthur Haynes?
Well, I went to Birmingham from Atlanta in November, within a week or 10 days of accepting the case. And Mr. Haynes, his wife and brother-in-law and his wife, took me to a club. We spent the evening together, and we talked as to what we said. I don't attempt to recall, but I had difficulty getting the any information from Mr. Haynes. I had to have him cited for contempt by Judge Battle to get whatever I did get from him.
Foreman was so full of malarkey.
This is Art Haynes Jr. reacting to Foreman's charge that he and his father withheld their files from Foreman. It should be remembered that Foreman pushed his way into this case and was the reason Haynes was dismissed. But the four-month work product of Haynes' father and son did not suddenly belong to Foreman because Ray was now his client. Even so, according to Art Haynes Jr., they were willing to share the work they had done.
He came through Birmingham, and we offered him that file. We offered to sit down with him. We offered to outline our defense with him. All he wanted to do, and all we did, was feed him steak and Scotch whiskey at the club in Birmingham and hear him ramble on about what a fabulous lawyer he was. I saw absolutely no evidence ever, either directly or secondhand, of any inclination or willingness on his part to defend that case as it should have been defended.
Attorney Mark Lane, who represented James Earl Ray in the late 1970s, sought out Arthur Haynes Sr. and was generously given access to his files as Foreman would have been had he had the interest. While they were meeting, Lane asked Haynes what he thought of Foreman, especially after their meeting at the club in Birmingham. Mr. Haynes replied, "My judgment is that the man never considered trying the case. As far as I can ascertain, he never prepared and he never investigated. He never considered giving James Earl Ray a trial. For what reason, I don't know."
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So Foreman said that the Haynes boys would not give him anything, while Haynes Jr. and Sr. claimed they were shocked by Foreman's lack of interest in the case. So who was telling the truth? Smart money would be on Art Haynes Sr., because first of all, Judge Preston Battle never cited him for contempt in this matter. And second, Haynes was upset enough about the whole thing that a few days later he felt compelled to take the unusual step to write a letter to Judge Battle, a letter that is still in the official files. "It is my distinct impression," he wrote, "that Foreman is disinterested in making a genuine effort to obtain the benefit from the fruits of our labor. His brief visit from a layover between planes has been the only contact we've had with him." At the House Select Committee hearing, Congressman McKinney of Connecticut question Foreman on his hard sell of the plea bargain to Ray.
You had a government case where ballistics were weak. You had a key eyewitness who was an alcoholic. You had testimonial conflicts on when the bundle was dropped in front of the store. There were no prints found in the rooming house or in the bathroom. Solomon Jones placed the shooter outside of the area at the time. And finally, Ray had never in his background had any history of quote-unquote violence. Doesn't that bring the odds down to a little better than 100%? I mean, you're a pretty tough lawyer. I've reviewed some of the work you've done, and wouldn't that give you a fighting chance for reasonable doubt?
Foreman disagreed.
My experience in a half a century of defending criminal cases makes me evaluate a case from a lot of standpoints that is not available to the average dispassionate observer.
So Foreman pulled rank and said his years in court gave him special insight into what was winnable and what wasn't, even though on many occasions he had gotten people way more guilty than Ray appeared to be off scot-free. But what was missing here was the follow-up question. Foreman was a busy guy. Why would he push his way into a case if he knew from the start that all he would do was oversee a plea bargain that the prosecution had already offered? And after that deed had been done, publicly pat himself on the back for pulling off this miracle and saving this man's life? None of this rings true. Let's return to the House committee.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could ask the committee clerk to hand to Mr. Foreman a copy of Martin Luther King Exhibit F-253. I'll describe this exhibit for the record. This is a copy of a Look magazine article. It's dated April 15th, 1969. The title of the article, excuse me, is Against Conspiracy. The author is Mr. Foreman, the witness today, captioned as Attorney for James Earl Ray. You recognize the article, Mr. Foreman?
I do.
Did you write the article?
Yes.
Wonder if I could direct your attention, please, to the second paragraph in the article. And if you'd follow along with me, I'll read that for the record. When, last November, the brothers of James Earl Ray sought me out and handed me a letter from him beseeching me to represent him,
now, this
article,
that
then,
language is not mine.
Mr. Foreman,
that language is Bradford Huey. He rewrote this. I wrote it as a lawyer would write it.
The issue here is this. James Earl Ray said he never invited Percy Foreman to visit him in jail, that he just appeared and was given entry and then pitched Ray as to why he would be the better choice for an attorney. Ray liked the part where he said he was rich enough that he wouldn't need to depend on literary contracts, and that he'd be able to testify at his own trial, which is what he wanted. But for the House committee, the issue was whether Foreman had been asked to appear by Ray himself, not his brother. And if he had not, Foreman was on shaky legal ground. Foreman had responded that Ray had written him a letter at his office in Houston, asking for him to enter the case.
I did receive such a letter. It came to my office on the 8th of, about the 8th, 7th or 8th of November. And I was in Waco or near Waco trying a lawsuit. When the letter came, it was read to me over the phone.
Who read the letter to you?
My secretary.
Did you have an opportunity when you returned to your office to see Mr. Ray's letter?
Yes, I did.
But James Earl Ray insisted that he hadn't written any such letter. And that would be a rather bold story to tell, because if he had, all Foreman would have to do to prove him a liar was produce it. But Foreman couldn't. He said the letter was apparently lost with all his other files on the case. Foreman was becoming visibly uncomfortable. He had begun this discussion by telling the House committee that he wrote the article in Look magazine. Then the story was that Huey had polished a sentence or two. Suddenly, it seemed safer to say that none of the words were his.
The entire article was rewritten, every line of it. I was right like a lawyer, with long, six-cylinder Latin words. Huey writes for the public. He translated to make it readable.
I do not speak literally. When I say all of it's mine, I meant the sense and spirit of the article. I do not mean the literal word by word.
So let's take this explanation. What is Foreman's sense and spirit of the article in Look magazine? What does it tell us? Remember, Ray's guilty plea fixed in the public mind, if there had been any doubt, that James Earl Ray and no one else had murdered Martin Luther King. But why? That was still up for grabs. And who would know better than Percy Foreman, Ray's attorney? Just so everyone would understand what a regular guy he was, Foreman said early in the article that he always assumed that Ray was guilty, but that he took the case to save Ray's life. This is most certainly a lie because, as attorney Art Haynes has told us, Ray already had a plea offer before Foreman showed up. In the article, Foreman goes on to group Ray with Oswald and Sirhan, the alleged killers of John and Robert Kennedy, respectively, all of whom wanted, according to Foreman, a shortcut to fame. They wanted credit, he wrote, top billing, headlines, front page pictures. But Oswald, just before he was murdered, said he was a patsy. Sirhan said he couldn't remember the crime. And Ray said he didn't shoot Martin Luther King. So whatever they did or didn't do, it doesn't seem as though any of them was looking for fame. But according to Foreman, Ray made special efforts to make sure that he got credit for this crime. Before he fled the murder scene, Foreman wrote, James Earl Ray carefully deposited on the sidewalk the murder weapon that he had wrapped in his own bed cover to protect his fingerprints on the rifle from being obliterated. Ray thought a war between the races was imminent, and he wanted to fire the first shot. The shooting of Dr. King was to him the Pearl Harbor of that war. The presumption here is that because Foreman was Ray's attorney, he knew these damning things about Ray because Ray had told him. But Ray always said he had nothing to do with the package wrapped in the bedspread found on the street. He never told Foreman that he placed the package there or that he wrapped it carefully so as not to erase his fingerprints. This is Foreman's invention. And of course, if Ray had wanted the rifle to point back to him so he would get credit for the crime, as Foreman was now saying, he could have just left it in his room and gotten a better start out of town. And Ray never said to anyone, much less Foreman, that he wanted to fire the first shot in a race war that he was trying to start. These are lies, rather vicious lies. Vicious because they would shape the way people all over America would see Ray as a ruthless killer driven by hatred. So Percy Foreman pushed his way into the case, talking about what an easy win it would be, made himself scarce as he attended to other business, and then showed up one day saying that Ray had to plead guilty. And after Ray made the plea, Foreman published an article where he congratulated himself for saving Ray's life and then went on to assassinate his character. What was he doing here? Who was he working for? Is there anything in Foreman's subsequent history that might give us a clue? Turns out there is. In 1975, Percy Foreman received a felony indictment for obstruction of justice from a federal grand jury in Texas. What did he do? In 1970, just 1 year after Foreman leaned on Ray to plead guilty, Herbert and Nelson Bunker Hunt, the sons of Texas billionaire H.L. Hunt, hired private detective John Kelly to do some illegal wiretapping. But he got caught. The Hunt brothers didn't want to go to jail, so they offered Kelly money if he would not testify against them. But Kelly didn't want to go to jail either. Then Percy Foreman shows up, offers his services to Kelly, and promises to keep him out of jail. Kelly pays Foreman a retainer of $1,000, but as soon as the ink is dry on their contract, Foreman approaches the Hunt brothers and says that he has Kelly, quote, under control. And if the Hunts will give Foreman $50,000, he will guarantee that Kelly will not incriminate them. As the indictment tells us, Foreman is paid his money and then goes back to Kelly, acting all concerned, and reminds him that the Hunts are very rich with mob connections and they would think nothing of killing him. So it's Foreman's recommendation, as his lawyer, that Kelly go to jail and say nothing about the Hunts. After all, says Foreman, according to the indictment, the government can't help you a whole lot if you're dead. But by sheer accident, Kelly finds out about the double cross, and Foreman and the Hunt brothers are indicted for obstruction of justice, a crime that might well have cost Foreman his license to practice law. But the people Foreman is in trouble with are very wealthy and connected. There are negotiations, time goes by, and the charges are quietly dropped. But the facts are really not in dispute. Foreman found a weak client with powerful people on the other side. He signed up the client, shopped him around, and received $50,000 for making sure the client pled guilty and didn't involve anyone else. Does that storyline sound familiar? Did Foreman do something of the same with James Earl Ray? Well, we think he did, and we think we have the evidence to prove it. So we will come back to this story later in the podcast and take a trip to Mr. Foreman's office in Houston.
Next time on the MLK tapes.
Showers was in the frame right from the beginning because he was the one who ran Jim's grill.
He looked like he had stuck his finger in the socket. Lord, hair was standing up, and he looked like somebody had drained all the blood out of his body. He was so white. Oh, he was so white.
I said, Lord, I said, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about the fact you may have been involved in the Martin Luther King assassination. And he said, well, they had a lot of people talking about it. He said, there's one thing, sure, that blanket of black's not coming back.
But he said when he went to the back door, just as he got to the door, a shot rang out. And somebody came out of the bushes and handed him a smoking rifle.
He wanted me to tell the truth about seeing him with a rifle. He just wanted me to change it just a little bit by saying, I saw him standing in the back door and a black man passing him a rifle.
Did James Earl Ray kill Dr. Martin Luther King?
No, he did not.
Do you know who killed Dr. King?
I know who was paid to do it.
Thanks for listening to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. This podcast is not specifically endorsed by the King family or the King Estate. The MLK Tapes is written and hosted by Bill Klaber. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, with producers Trevor Young and Ben Kiebrick. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, with producers Jamie Albright and Meredith Stedman. Original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Cover art by Mr. Soul 216, with photography by Artemis Jenkins. Special thanks to Owen Rosenbaum and Grace Royer at UTA, The Nord Group, Beck Media and Marketing, Envision Business Management, and Station 16. If you have questions, you can visit our website, themlktapes.com. We posted photos and videos related to the podcast on our social media accounts. You can check them out at themlktapes. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.